just framing the issue here, so I'm going to go through this pretty quickly so that I can, but open access is compatible with peer review. And when we talk about open access to research type desk peer review, provide open access to peer review, but provide peer review themselves don't get paid for it. Don't have to deliver just the way the open access is compatible with copyright, and there's ways to make that work. And other specializations here at the body. But open access is compatible with copyright as it is now. There are kinds of copyright reform that are compatible with revenue and profit. Of course, with print, you can always print out a digital edition. It's compatible with preservation both on the digital side and on the print side, where authors work by the career advancement that they. This is a snapshot of the worldwide momentum for open access. As of last night, there are 3,600 peer-reviewed open access journals in all countries and all languages. There are over 1,200 open access repositories. Most of these are universities open access to. 22 universities around the world require their faculty to provide open access, and some 7 funding agencies around the world provide open access. Yeah, the slides will be available online afterwards. Next slide has a few more numbers. I wanted to give a glimpse of the problem for providing open access to developing countries and why it problems that researchers. Journal prices have risen 4 times faster than inflation since they've been rising faster than inflation since the 70s. So even the wealthiest universities in the world have to cancel journals or cap out and offer their faculty access to five orders of contrast. Harvard, which is the wealthiest university library in the world, gives its faculty access to nearly 100,000. Yale, which is the second, average day out of the library. Best funded research library in India provides 10,600. One of the 2 best funded research libraries in Africa provides. University of Malawi provides 17,000. That's just there because some number of those, well, I had contributed that by the help of IFU. Part of the cost is donated, and without that donation, the university has access only to 95 print journals. Scholars, African scholars, publishing in 2005, 2006, and 2007, said that some sub-Saharan African university libraries have 0. Open access is possible in all disciplines, all categories, the urgency is great. Public-funded research is fair return to taxpayers. Case for medical research is especially strong, and that more knowledge matters. The more research from developing countries, I think, is. Panelists will discuss the problems that make open access, the challenges facing dividing open access, and some working examples of it. And without further ado, I'll leave the instructions under the intro. Al Rahu.
Keep it on.
Yeah.
Friends, the past 2.5 days, we have been talking about different aspects of access to knowledge. In this session, we are going to talk about access to scientific knowledge, in particular, access to scientists and students of science. Science is created by researchers, and science is not done in isolation. Scientists work as a worldwide community. It is a community activity. While we do science, we depend upon the work of others. Others in terms of space and time, people who might have done research years ago and people who are currently doing elsewhere and so on. So we depend upon each other's work to perform science. Therefore, it is important that we share knowledge with each other. And science is about sharing. And for a very long time, scientists used to make their new knowledge known to others by printed journals, through printed journals. That was the medium available to them at the time. They were doing that. It had some problems in the sense it cost a lot of money to print and post to send it away to people. But today we have technologies such as the internet and the web. Therefore, it becomes much easier to make things available worldwide. Science has its purpose as the most important purpose of science is to create new knowledge. Knowledge that would benefit humanity. There are different kinds of people who do science. People who do science purely with pencil and paper, we call them theorists, and people who do research in laboratories or in the field and do experiments and submit the results for publication, we call them experimentalists. They are also in different kinds of institutions, like academic institutions, like corporations, like IBM, Microsoft, or Eli Lilly, and so on, or NGOs, and so on and so forth. So it's a mixed bag of people, all trying to create new knowledge that will be available to everybody for sharing and for benefit of humanity as a whole. Over a period of time, as Peter Subert pointed out, the price of these journals went up very high. In the sense, it outpaced the regular inflation by a factor of 3 or 4. And it became difficult even for well-endowed libraries in the Western world to buy all the journals that the scientists and scholars would require. what to talk of developing countries. So it became difficult for scientists to share knowledge through the printed journals. And that is when librarians, particularly in the US, Association of Research Libraries and others, and scientists elsewhere, join hands to look for options other than printed journals, which cost so much money. Thus came open access, thanks to the availability of internet and World Wide Web at the same time. And one of the key purposes of this open access movement in science and scholarship is to restore the knowledge commons to the creators of knowledge, namely scientists and researchers. But this movement is, like any other movement, is rather uneven. It is successful in some places and not so successful in other places. For example, in countries like the United States, United Kingdom, and the Netherlands, there's a strong movement towards open access, and there are many initiatives which have succeeded in those countries. Similarly, in certain fields like physics, open access is a success. In the sense, way back in 1991, Paul Ginspark founded what is called ARCHIVE, a major international repository for all of physics. But chemistry, which is an allied field for physics, is virtually strangled by a society of chemists. And they are unable to match physicists in providing open access to their communities. Among the third world countries, Brazil and to some extent other countries in Latin America are doing pretty well, but not China, not even India. I will tell you a little about science in India and what kind of policy initiatives that we are taking in India towards achieving full open access. India is a vast country with more than 1.1 billion people, and we are one of the largest educational, higher education systems in the world. We also have many laboratories and scientists, and the government is reasonably considerate towards science right from the early days of independence. And they have been funding very well for a poor country. And India publishes currently a little over 3% of papers indexed in chemical abstracts, about 30,000 papers indexed in the Science Citation Index of Thomson Reuters, and so on. Of course, it is a peanuts compared to what the Chinese are doing. Today, China is number two in the world in terms of number of publications, in number of patents, and so on. One of the problems Indian scientists face is common to all developing country scientists. The paper that I publish is not seen by my own colleagues in other laboratories in my own country, because I publish in a journal which is published elsewhere, say in Netherlands or US or UK. And then when it costs so much, many libraries in India are unable to buy, and therefore scientists working in those laboratories wouldn't know what I have done, although it must be greatly relevant to their own work. So this is a tragedy. All of us are funded by the government of India for research. 70% of research in India is funded by the government. And I draw money from my taxpayer. My colleague also draws his money from his taxpayer. And we work in isolation, and our work is not shared with each other, which is not good at all. This is one. The second is visibility. Second is access. To do research, I should be able to get all the journals that I need, and my library is unable to buy, therefore I am not able to do as well as I could. Now, certain new developments in India have sorted out the first problem of access. We have formed a consortia of academic institutions, research institutions, and so forth, and we are able to provide a large number of journals, like Elsevier Science Direct and so on, tens of thousands. Like Peter pointed out, the Institute of Science gets more than 10,000 journals. So we also provide a lot of open courseware like MIT, and large number of physicists use ARCHIVE and so on. On the policy front, in my opinion, whatever has happened so far has happened because of individual efforts. Committed individuals, motivated people, try to do something and they achieve. I would name a few of them. There was a president of the Indian National Science Academy, a medical doctor, a cardiac surgeon, Dr. Valiathan. He was very receptive to the idea of open access when we spoke to him, and then he made all the journals of the academy open access. And there is Dr. Sahu here, you will hear him from him soon, how an individual and his company made a large number of journals open access. And there is a private company called the Informatics in Bangalore. They set up what is called Open J-Gate for providing access to all open material in science and scholarship through a secondary service. And a young librarian in the National Institute of Technology in Roorkela called Madan, he persuaded his director to mandate self-archiving for his institute's faculty and students, and I think his mandate came before the Harvard mandate. The National Knowledge Commission, India has a knowledge commission, and I was on two of those committees, and my recommendation to open access was accepted by the commission, and they have placed it before the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister and the Chairman of the Planning Commission have accepted, but action is yet to take place. This is a major problem. In most developing countries, we will have pious resolutions, but action will take years to follow, or it may not happen at all. There's a big gap between intentions and implementation. There are a number of institutional repositories in India, but most of, about 40, but more than half of them are not getting filled at all. They're there, but nothing happens. We need to have a large number of advocacy programs and training programs to bring in more people to work in the area of open access. Key players are not acting at all. For example, I said Dr. Valiathan, the academy president, was willing to devote time and energy to set up open access. But the secretaries to the government of India in the departments of science or department of biotechnology are the two advisors, an advisor to the cabinet, scientific advisor to the cabinet of India, as well as the scientific advisor to the prime minister. They have not spoken a word about open access till today. Not a word. Luckily for me, for us, the new director general of the Council of Scientific and Industrial Research is a biotechnologist. He's interested in genomics, and therefore he's interested in open sharing of data, and he's initiating action for open source drug discovery in India. And he has agreed that all his 38 laboratories, which produce approximately 4,000 papers a year, will go open access. He has agreed. I do not know when it will happen, so he has agreed. Now I'll turn to my last point. One of the key things for developing countries is medicine, because a lot of people suffer from a lot of diseases, the neglected diseases, which were referred to in the previous session. And hardly any pharmaceutical company is coming forward to invent new drugs and so on. So it is important for poor countries to take care of their citizens, especially from those neglected diseases. We need to build tremendous amount of scientific and technical research capabilities. It is no longer possible for any country to survive on the research done by other people alone. They also need to have their own capabilities. So we need to give priorities for neglected diseases and so on. It is in this context, HINARI becomes very important. HINARI provides a lot of information to poor country people. But there are some reservations about HINARI. First, although they said any country that would have a per capita income of less than $1,000 a year will be eligible to get HINARI journals for free, several countries in Asia, including India, are not in that list. And then it requires access only through designated libraries and so on. You have to use passwords and so on. In my opinion, if only the librarians who initiated this movement and the WHO who supported it have invested that time and energy on promoting open access to scientific and scholarly literature rather than negotiating with commercial publishers for HINARI, I think the results would have been far more useful to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon to everyone, and I thank first Yale ISP and Professor Suber for this invitation. Very quickly, in the next 10 minutes, I'll go through my personal experience of open access publishing in the field of medicine. I don't have to emphasize on the importance of access to knowledge because we are in conference related to access to knowledge, but particularly in the field of medicine, information or knowledge is very critical. I draw attention to these three news items from the lay media. One is about chikungunya goes Italian, that was about a year back. India becoming global hub for diabetes. And how safe are clinical trials? All these are very important as news items. One is about no country can be spared from infectious disease. It could be chikungunya today. Polio tomorrow, a lot of nations have been made polio free, but still there are viruses there spreading. And the developing countries are now becoming prone to non-infectious diseases, which were more prevalent previously in the developed nations. And the drugs which are being developed are being, the clinical trials for those are being outsourced to low-income countries. We are not sure about the safety and efficacy of those drugs unless the knowledge, the information about those clinical trials is made very clear. This aspect is I'm not going to cover about registration of clinical trials and openness of clinical trials. I'll just quickly go through about few of the well-known open access publishing projects. One of them is, not this particular journal is not the model for an open access journal for medicine, but this journal has been put online through an open source journal publishing software called Open Journal System. Public Library of Science is an NGO. They have about 7 journals, mainly in medicine and biology. Biomed Central is the largest open access publisher. They have about 189 medical journals. Cielo, and if NGO and efforts from governmental agencies now provides access to more than 550 journals, mainly from Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Cuba, Portugal, and other countries. Then we have BioLine International, an international agency, a collaboration of Canada and Brazil. They are providing access to more than 60 journals from developing countries. In India, we have this InMed and MedIn, which provides access to 40 medical journals from India. PubMed Central is not a journal publishing activity, but it's an archive of journals. It has now over 150 journals. These were the few international initiatives, activities in publishing medical journals. Now coming to our personal experience of publishing journals, we are publishing now 75 journals, not just from India, but from UK, USA, Nigeria, Ghana, and Saudi Arabia. All these journals are peer-reviewed journals. They follow the peer review as, say, JAMA or NEJM or Lancet follows. Most of these journals are printed, available in print form as well as in online version. The online version is open to everyone. Nobody has to have a registration, username, password. Anyone can access and download the files, including the PDF files. This is one of our first journals called Journal of Postgraduate Medicine. It's been online since last 7 years. It belongs to a very small medical college in Mumbai called St. G.S. Medical College. The journal is official publication of staff society of that medical college. So the journal virtually goes to nobody else except the 280 staff members of that medical college. So the journal has 280 print copies which are printed for each issue and just a couple of more copies for the subscribers. For a quarterly journal with 280 printed copies, we have last 1 month's statistics on its website. It gets on average about 2,700 visitors on its website every day. There have been 81,000 visitors in last 1 month. It's a journal, quarterly journal with just 300 print copies. And from where do we get these visitors? They're spread all over the world, wherever there is internet connection. And maximum number of visitors come from London. Last 1 month had about 2,600 visitors coming from London. Just see similar statistics for some other journals. Here is a journal from Saudi Arabia called Annals of Thoracic Medicine. Though London is again the number one city, we have the second largest number of visitors from Rosario in last 1 month. A journal from South Africa. Maximum number of visitors are from Melbourne. So these are the journals published from developing countries, but the maximum number of visitors are from other countries, mainly from USA and UK. Can anybody tell where this journal is being published from? This journal is a new launch from Nigeria called African Journal of Pediatric Surgery. The journal was being published for quite some time. We put it online on 7th June, and in last 3 months we have visitors from all over the world. And just a couple of days back I received a mail from the Thomson Reuters saying that they would like to evaluate the journal for inclusion in Science Citation Index. So a journal which was not visible to anybody gets attention in the eyes of ISI. And how does the journal benefit from this visibility? The first and most important is the articles which are coming to the journals. As I was discussing just a few minutes back, most of the journals, let it be the journals from developed countries or developing countries, they have three major problems. One is the editorial time. No technology can provide that. But the next two are finances and quality and quantity of articles. Open access helps to get rid of the last problem, that is quantity and quality of articles. We have results of 7 journals, last 5 years, 6 years data. The number of articles are more or less increasing for most of the journals. In fact, we have a journal which is from Saudi Arabia, which is accepting articles. Now, if they are accepting an article, they are putting it in queue for 2010 issues. And we are getting a lot of articles from outside India. The other advantage, since we are getting more articles, we are publishing more number of articles, we are publishing more number of original research papers, and with good number of articles coming for submission, we are publishing the journals regularly. I am sure the librarians over here would know that journals from developing countries usually do not follow a fixed schedule. If it's a January-March issue, it might come in January, March, or it might come in April also. So we have now more and more of journals are coming regularly. In fact, we have increased the frequency of many of our journals in the last 2 years. 8 of our journals have changed their frequency. Say, suppose it was published 2 times in a year, now we are publishing 4 times and maybe 6 times also. That's very important. It gives an idea that we have good number of articles and the finances are also sound. One more major advantage of open access is that we can check off scientific misconduct. I'll give an example of a journal called Indian Journal of Ophthalmology. The journal is now 55th year. We got the journal for publication in 2005. We put the journal online in 2005 with the 2005 issues. Over a period of time, now the journal has put its first volume, first issue also online. The moment we put the 2003 issue online, the editor receives a mail from USA saying that one of the articles is plagiarized. And it's not just plagiarized, the entire article, except for the author name, was copied from somebody else, somewhere else. So it's open access. If the journal was not put online, not made available for free access, nobody would have found out this plagiarism. Similarly, scientific misconduct, falsification of data is very easy to catch now with free access to literature. And recently we had a workshop from a senior scientific advisor from ISI, Thomson Reuters, where he asked a question to the editors attending the workshop that what is the most important thing for your journal. The editor said, first to get indexed in Science Citation Index and to have an impact factor. That's the craze for the medical journal editors, especially from developing countries. And here we have, last 2 years we have got 11 journals indexed in Science Citation Index. And what is most important for us to note is that these journals are getting indexed on their own. Now we don't have to run after ISI that please index our journals. They select which journals have already achieved a good visibility, getting good citations, and they index it. Out of 11, probably we might have applied for 2 or 3 journals. Rest they have indexed on their own. So let's see about citations and impact factor. His comparison of 4 journals, not the Science Citation Index impact factor, but the SJR, Shimago Journal Ranking, which is very similar to impact factor. It's based on the citations of last 3 years. Here we have a journal, our first journal, Journal of Postgraduate Medicine. The journal went online in 2001, and it's showing progressive increase in impact factor, in fact the citations, and the 3 other medical journals from India, there has been no increase, in fact they are going down in their citations. Compare the same journal with some other journals in other disciplines from India, they are not showing, they are not open access, they are not visible to anybody, then nobody is reading those journals, nobody is citing those journals. Let's see impact of going online and the citations. We have 4 journals over here. The moment you put the journal online, say this journal went online in 2001, you see increase in citations. This journal was online in 2000, increasing its citation, this went online in 2004, and then you have citations going up by 3 and 4 times. One question we are always asked is, what happens to your print subscriptions? The journals are available in print version on payment basis. Are we losing the print subscription? The answer is no. We have figures for 7 journals here for last 6 years. Maybe the little dip over here, but most of the journals are getting more subscription, more readers, because the more readers are finding them useful and they're subscribing the print edition. Last about just how open access can help to improve the scientific output of the nation. May not be in true sense the output, but at least because of their international recognition in scientific databases, they can show that their output is improved. Here's comparison of the BRIC nations in the field of engineering. You find that China has made tremendous progress. There's a huge gap between the 3 other nations, compared to China. As far as engineering is concerned, almost same is true for social sciences. But in medicine, you'll find that in India is here the blue one, Brazil is here green. The gap between India and China, or Brazil and China, is a little narrower. That's because most of the journals in India and Brazil are open access. They get indexed in Science Citation Index, Scopus and other databases, and that's the main reason the scientific output in India in medical field has not increased in last 3 or 4 years, but it's the international recognition of these journals which have helped to show increase in the scientific output of the nation. Last, most important is what we are doing. Open access publishing is not sufficient to ensure that the nation, developing nations or even the developed nation, will have the continued access to information which is published in these journals. When we define open access, we are talking about perpetual access to the information. Why? Because many of these journals which have done well now might be grabbed by an international publisher, commercial publisher. He comes up to India, says that this good journal, we'd like to publish, and take away the free access. Or the editor changes, he doesn't know how to continue with his website, and he loses the continuity. That's important. And last is, most of the scientists in developing countries in India would like to publish in the journals which are high impact factor journals. So they, and most of the scientists in these countries do not have access to those journals. That's 20-80 phenomena, where 80% of the results is published in 20% of high impact factor journals, which are, as we know, is not available to most of the researchers and scientists in developing countries. This is all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter. Again, also want to thank the organizers and ISB program. And it is a special delight and honor to be in a panel organized by Peter, because as Laura said, he is the leading light in open access and certainly one of the brightest thinkers in this area. Has taken us a long way over the last few years. I want to also acknowledge the fact that a lot of these works have been done at a grassroots level, and Sahu have just given you a tremendous demonstration of what an individual and organizations and his network can do. And I mean, speaking of network, Arun is a human network, and he's been behind the scene connecting people. In fact, he connected me and Sahu up a few years ago before he started all this. In 5 years' time, you've seen the progress of this. So I want to applaud the funders like Open Society Institutes and other agencies to fund these kind of grassroots level project, because they make a big difference. Now, I was asked by Peter, I only discovered that close to today, that I was supposed to talk about university and researchers. And on that note, I could say that unlike what I said earlier, the grassroots movement, university and researchers in university have been sort of been dragging their feet, and I think this is kind of ironic, because a lot could be done from a lot of these rich institutions, particularly from the north, and I will give some examples of why this is important. In fact, because so much of what I want to say has been covered by my two previous speakers, I'm going to take the liberty of telling you a story first, because that story was going to be told at the end of this presentation. But I think I was afraid that if there may not enough time, so I'm going to tell the story now. And I have permission from my colleague named Timbala Kape, who's recently joined our faculty 2 years ago. Now, Timbala's originally from South Africa, has done a lot of interesting work in land use and indigenous land use rights and conservations in South Africa. Since he's been hired on to the University of Toronto, he's been asked that he should stop publishing his work in African journals, where he has been doing his publishing, because he will not get tenure if he keep on publishing journals, publishing in journals of these low impact and non-existent journals, according to our faculty, because they are not indexed in ISI, and because they are not ranked, and they're not on the radar screen of the tenure and review committee. I think many of you are familiar with this particular story. But the dilemma that Timbala faces is this, that a lot of his work are supposed to be for those who have to make use of his findings. That is, policy with regard to land use, policy with regard to conservation, policy with regard to the allocation of resources for different research on fruit crops and so forth that have very direct impact on the people on which he did the research on. So if you were to publish those findings in journals that are not accessible to the people who were supposed to benefit from them, is he fulfilling his role as a researcher? So he has an ethical dilemma, a big one. On the one hand, he has to get tenure so that he can support his family. On the other hand, he feels he's turning his back on the people for whom he had exploited, as he said, if he did not pay back in terms of the findings that he's publishing. Now, he also told me that one of his most cited papers was a small paper he published in the South African Journal. It was picked up by the government policymaker, and in fact had a very strong impact locally in terms of local policy, and is picked up by other agencies and by other researchers, and have then since rippled throughout his research area. Now, that particular paper is poorly cited, in fact not cited at all according to ISI impact factor. So I would like to suggest to you that impact factor, quote number one, is evil. And it is ironic that while open access is supposed to have started to counter the tyranny of impact factor, as successful as many of these open access journals are, now they're turning to impact factor as a way to then battle out in this arena. So I would like to caution that one of the interesting and most promising area of open access is allowing us to engage in looking at alternative impact measurement and looking at policy impact, looking at other tangible social impact and so forth are a way to go forward. Hopefully I'll still have enough time to give you some practical example on how this is being done. Now, originally I was going to talk about these differences of the big science, little science, but Arun has really covered all that already in terms of the plight of the researchers in developing countries like India, and Sahu have given you a very good example of the so-called gold road to open access, which is open access publishing. So what I will do later is to talk a little bit more about institutional repositories, which is the other major role for open access, particularly for researchers in the university and research settings across the world. Not to forget, earlier this morning, and we were talking about big science, this morning this thing just fired off, I don't know how it went, but this is probably big science in the most extreme. You're talking about billions of dollars, talking about many nations, you're talking about thousands of scientists collaborating on this project to build this massive thing so that these tiny little things can collide at the speed of light. And it is supposed to solve a lot of problems about the universe. Now, not to say that big science like this is not important, but to point out that there are a lot of investment, a lot of collaboration, a lot of interest in science like this, and I'm just going to put that aside. This morning, someone said, well, they don't know what's going to happen when they turn this on. Perhaps it will create a black hole and suck us all in. My thought is we already have a big hole, and it's called the 1090 gap, and we've been facing this big hole for a long time and still having a big problem filling it. So I'm just thought in the counter, kind of in the juxtaposition, it would be quite interesting if we're all that money, the colliding thing, were to put into this gap, what would happen? Just a fantasy. But this is familiar to most of you, that most of the resources are put into a small percentage of the world population and vice versa. So it's not surprising, again this has been covered by my colleague, that a lot of the scientific output is still dominated by the G8 countries. And of course, they're using ISI as a way to measure these output and to see which are the most cited nation. And not surprisingly, the G8 countries dominate 85% in terms of the scientists that are most cited. Now, I should add that a lot of these scientists that are most cited in these countries originate from developing countries. They migrate, like Timbala, to as countries in the north and do very well there. And again, the dilemma is whether to stay there or to return to the homeland. But often, the incentive is such that they end up staying. This is an interesting study of the content. Now, we talked about the number of journals in these different programs, how many journal access Yale has or Harvard has and so forth. I'm more interested in the content. That is, of all these numbers of journals, how much of it is relevant in terms of content to the needs of the developing countries? And this particular study is interesting because it looked at New England Journal of Medicine, of course one of the most top-ranked journals, and look at how much coverage they have in terms of developing country issues. And you can see that over a long period of time, the coverage of developing countries issue has not increased, and this is pretty staggering. So when journals are being sent to other parts of the world, either electronically or by other means, we are still operating with the model that Alan was talking about yesterday. That is, the assumption that somehow research that are done in the North is the stuff, that's the rich stuff that could be, should be given to the poor in the South, and they would benefit, they would just soak them all up, and everybody would be healthy, happy, and educated. So we have continually these lost science, so-called lost science, in the developing world. And I think we continue to have this cycle of poverty dependency. And it's interesting that over 30 years of development aids, we really haven't learned these lessons very well. So the Academy of Sciences of these African academies a number of years ago got together, have tried to put their head together and say, how did they build infrastructure that would then serve the local research needs better? And again, I'm sure there are many, many initiatives. In this room alone, I found out there are several initiatives that are designed to build infrastructures in Africa. And I would urge that we must talk together to make sure that, that they are, in fact, serving local needs and that we're not inventing wheels left, right, and centers. And these testimonials are not uncommon, and Arun again given you some example. But again, in the area of health, these are particularly pressing and important. A survey that was done by the WHO a number of years ago, again, not surprising, found that most developing countries' researchers want to have access to journals, and they also found that there are very few institutions actually have any access at all at the time. So the Hanari program has proven to be a very important one in terms of providing access to a large number of journals from the North, and there are a lot of collaborators, and again, there are a lot of open access journals also included in the database as well, so that the Mano journals there, the Bioline journals and so forth are also included in there. And the idea is to include journals not only from the developed world, but to ensure that there are also journals that are originated from the regions themselves, from various parts of the world, because they do research as some journals show, and many of them have increasingly good quality, and these journals need to be accessed by other researchers in the South. And so I couldn't help when I went on the Elsevier website. They were quite happy to be part of the Hanari program, but they say that this is dissemination through information philanthropy. And I would, again, strongly object to this particular view of information access, because it is not about philanthropy. We want to benefit as a global community in terms of research and health and so forth. We don't live in little bubbles. A lot of these executives don't know that. So open access is supposed to be a way to change the one directional flow and to increase the kind of South-South collaboration. Now, of course, it has to be possible only because of the internet. And right now, as we mentioned many times, there are two primary routes to open access, and you heard a lot about journals, but repositories may be a little bit less familiar to some of you, so in my remaining 2 minutes, I'm going to give you a quick tour of it. And I'm going to skip through a bunch of these slides, so you might want to close your eyes so you don't get dizzy. But before I do that, I want to again reiterate the importance of local research in terms of strengthening local research capacity, providing kind of important venues for researchers to practice writing and reviewing, but more importantly, to look at problems of local significance and allow policymakers to access evidence so that they can make better decisions based on local research rather than research that are imported. These are the open access stuff I won't talk about. I wanted to plug this project because I'm involved, but you can go look at it later because Sahu already talked a lot. But this one particular journal I will come back to, African Health Sciences, because this is another interesting anecdote. 2 years ago, there was an article published in this journal looking at the use of colocrine in Uganda and a number of East African countries, and the authors found that over 50% of the drugs were actually either substandard or fake or counterfeit. And that particular local study caught the attention of the local newspaper, put it online, and then caught the attention of the BBC, and caught the attention of other researchers, and then other researchers from outside start looking at similar issue locally. So you do have interesting rippling effects from local research. This particular journal is online for free through our system, but they are also online for free on PubMed, which is a central repository many of you know about. But again, less well-known are institutional repositories, and many universities now have their own institutional repository. These are digital repositories that are using free open source software. They are interoperable with other repositories. So once you put your paper in it, and I want to emphasize peer review published paper, by and large, other people can search it and link to it and find it from anywhere with the internet access. So when you have a series of interconnected repositories, you basically have a connected global network of knowledge from research institutions. All kinds of benefits for authors. So going back to my friend Tembela, so he had this dilemma, his paper published in these journals that his friend cannot access. So what we have done is to put his paper on our institutional repositories. Now, many publishers actually allow you to do that. They won't allow you to put the final PDF. And some of them have different embargo periods, some of them 6 months, some of them 12 months. But some of his papers are much older. They already passed the embargo period. So we have put a pile of his paper online. And we also are waiting for some of his paper to be out of embargo so that we can release them on the repository. And some of them we put final accepted peer review version online because that's what the publisher wants. And so now Tembela's is well accessed by his colleague. When his colleagues or anybody doing research in this area, they can go and search on the internet on Google Scholar and find his work. And there are other studies that have been done and a number of studies are emerging looking at citation impact. If that's still something that you're concerned with, and that there are different fields showing very, very significant differences between journal articles that are made open access and versus articles that are not made open access. Institution has a vested interest in providing institutional repositories for their own faculties and researchers because if they can showcase their work by their own faculties, it's easy for them to look through a whole range of the research output. And in the UK, now they're designing their research assessment exercise based on institutional repositories so that you have to put a copy of your paper after it's published in the repository, either open or closed, depending on the embargo policy, and then the evaluator can go in there and read the text and give you the kind of fair assessment after they have read it. And increasingly, we have more and more of these repositories. Many of you have heard about the MIT, and of course, recently Harvard has a policy that's at the Faculty of Arts and Science asking the members to deposit the work in their institutional repositories. So over the next few years, you will see a lot of these research findings available. Now, for funding bodies, in fact, are very keen about knowing what they funded, and in the past, they have very often don't know what kind of output resulted from the grants that they have given out, what kind of publication resulted from it, or even if they know, they have no access to it themselves. So that if the journal is published, if the paper is published in a journal they do not subscribe to themselves, they don't have a copy. So this is really a way for funders to really better handle and manage their research output, and also to check, make sure they're not duplicating the research and so forth funding. So there are lots of tangential benefits. Now, if you're interested in looking to see who has a repository and who hasn't and where they're distributed, you can go to this URL and you will find these different repositories scattered around the world. Not surprisingly, you have many of them in the United States and the UK and in Europe in general, and there are many collaborative program like the DRIVER program that is making these repository together, linking them together. But there are, in fact, many from developing countries in South Africa, Eve will talk about shortly, and in Latin America as well. This is actually something I was going to talk, I was going to show later. This is the paper, one of the examples of Timbala's paper, which costs $30 to access on the Springer website. And once we put it on our repository, all these papers are now accessible. You can also go to Google Scholar. You can see up there, there's a site by 20 people. This was done 3 months ago. And then yesterday, I gone back and look at the same paper. It says site by 24 people. And you can click on it and kind of trace who's citing him and create a network of citation. And again, I'm going to stop talking now. The idea is that open access does allow us to now engage in thinking about alternative way of looking at impact, social impact, policy impact, and other kinds of impact that is not just based on one number alone. So, and I do think that we have an obligation to ensure that these research that are given to us publicly funded are also accessible. University need to do more. Thank you.
Thank you. It's hard following on speeches like that. So much ground has been covered. But I am, in fact, going to take a slightly different tack, stepping back a little, pulling together everything that's been said. I want to take my own country, South Africa, as a case study in the particularly turbulent process of change. Because what we're talking about when we talk open access is change and change delivery. It doesn't happen smoothly, and it's quite interesting to track not just the intellectual property and copyright issues that have been dealt with a lot at this conference, but also the values, the cultures, the systems, the policies, the practices that underlie the process of moving towards more open access to knowledge and to scientific research. So this is where we come from. When this man walked out of jail and South Africa headed on a very, very belated path to independence and democracy, we faced probably the biggest challenge in terms of delivering change of any country in the world, probably just about ever. And in those 14 years, we've seen a process of massive delivery of policy, of transformation reports, of change management, of leveraging a country into another direction as we seek to undo what apartheid did to our country and colonialism beforehand. But before we move on, just something to think about, because I can't avoid using the language we use. Look at Nelson Mandela, and with him in mind, question throughout what I say, what is meant by international and what is meant by local? Is this man local? And at the risk of being slightly irreverent of a very big nation, is George Bush international? And in what way? Because that's going to come up quite a lot. Our current president had this to say about what South Africa needed to do. And it's interesting, it comes from a speech on the Timbuktu Library Project, which reminds us that Africa is also a continent of great publishing, literacy, and books. But what he's saying essentially is that what we need to do is revitalize our African perspectives and the knowledge that we generate for ourselves. This is happening now, this massive policy creation in a country which is a second economy country and has its own paradoxes. For example, here we are as the first country in the world to do a heart transplant. And this picture, incidentally, I can't tell you now, but has a whole copyright story behind it as well. This is Chris Barnard in 1967. In fact, this photograph, there's no photograph of the first one. This is the second heart transplant ever done in the world. We're a sophisticated enough scientific nation to be developing our own vaccines. We're delivering multi-array telescopes in the Karoo. We are involved in big projects like CERN. So at that level, we operate as a relatively leading scientific country. If you look at the state of the world, that's what you get. These maps, I don't know if you've seen them before, produced by World Mapper, use statistics to create a distorting effect. This is what the world looks like from the perspective of copyrights in scientific research publications. And you can see that we are minute. Down the bottom of Africa, South Africa is not too bad, but Africa for the rest is so skinny and starving that it barely appears. And we have this immense toad crouching above us with all the scientific knowledge in the world being channeled there. And the question is, how does that happen? How do we do this to ourselves? Sorry, I'm going wrong way. And the answer, I would say, is that we inflict it on ourselves. This is the Vice Chancellor of the University of Cape Town being installed 2 weeks ago. And you'll notice that, as somebody earlier commented, our intellectual property regimes are inherited from a colonial base and we don't question them. Here we have our Vice Chancellor who actually did question what was happening. He said his wife fell about laughing when he put on the funny hat that he had to wear. In terms of these medieval traditions that were evoked in African universities when we go into ceremonial mode. And it's a reminder that we are very colonial. And we haven't shaken these colonial traditions, we've tried. Dr. Price, in his Vice Chancellor's speech, spoke a lot about creating an African university and how you Africanize South African universities. And he spoke a lot about how one needs to create equity in research, but it was done in this mode. And what that tells me is that when you see a ceremony like this, you're seeing a visual representation of one of the major strands of research policy in a country like South Africa, and that is international competitiveness in a colonial tradition. How that expresses itself, we've already seen, is that publication is perceived as a matter of journal articles in international journals. And those journal articles are underpinned by citation counts and an almost religious value attached to them. If you want to climb the ladder in research in South Africa, and a recent study of research across sub-Saharan Africa in the South African Regional Universities Association endorses this, and Leslie's already mentioned, you've got to publish in international journals, in i.e. Thomson ISI journals, and there is therefore, and this is what is not often taken into account, there is little or no support for locally, for nationally based and locally published journals. The idea is that universities are not responsible for dissemination or publication. That happens somewhere else. It's a major version of the free rider syndrome. That means that publishing industries in our country struggle along on volunteer labor, no financial support, no university recognition. When we walked into the University of Cape Town and said, tell us what journals are published on campus, they said, we don't know. We only count authorship because we want to get the national government subsidy for publication in ISI and other accredited journals. So there's a black hole when it comes to looking at the dissemination of research out of Africa. And then you get to the other strand of policy, there is a body count to this failure to address the need to disseminate research and make it accessible. And that is the map of world poverty. Suddenly Africa gets much fatter. We're better at that. And this is a classic image from South Africa, the country with the biggest AIDS incidence in the world, 10% of the population suffering from HIV, people dying at the rate of thousands a day. And as Mampela Rampela, the ex-vice chancellor of UCT, said, if three jumbo jets crashed in America every day, it would be a national crisis. Yet nobody notices this happening in a country like South Africa. And this is a grandmother with the children she supports because their parents have died of AIDS. These are very real problems, and the other strand of government policy is to say that not only must South African universities be competitive, and this is where access becomes important, but that research has to address the burning social and economic issues of the country. And so there are very powerful things that have happened in the country in order to gear research and access to research goods towards the public good. We have a Medicines and Related Substances Control Act, and this is Zahi Akhmat from the Treatment Action Campaign, who forced the hand a bit of the pharmaceutical companies. Nelson Mandela was behind the original idea for this act. It's an act for parallel importation and compulsory licensing. But when it was passed, the international pharmaceutical companies sued South Africa, took them to court, led by the South African pharmaceuticals, and only backed down after publicity campaigns run by the likes of Zahi Akhmat, who flew back from Thailand with bags full of parallel licensed pills and asked to be arrested, and was. So things moved on. We have this legislation. Medications are available. Things are changing on other fronts as well. The South African government, through the Department of Science and Technology, is supporting open access publications through the Academies of Science. And we have examples like the Human Science Research Council, here publishing a book on the land and property rights of women and orphans in the context of HIV and AIDS, making two very important points. One is that if you're going to publish, if you have access to information on medical and scientific issues, you have to have a social science interface if these are going to be translated into the terms that make a difference in the country you're working in. The HSRC publishes all its books full text free online, and it publishes high quality print versions as well. The results, that's from the Cape Town Book Fair, the little flashing lights are the countries where HSRC breast books are downloaded. And there's only one country that doesn't download them, and somebody, if there's somebody here from Greenland, can they please explain? Greenland is the only country, except for two tiny war-torn African centers, that does not download these books. They are the primary source of policy, of information for policymakers, politicians, government ministers, and across the world, people reach for this research. It made a major difference in HIV/AIDS because it published the numbers, the statistics, the social information of AIDS incidents. So open access is powerful. There are also open access journals now developing, and once the Academy of Science sets up a platform for journals, which will happen within the year, you'll see a great increase in the output of South African research. But what else needs to be done? If we're going to deliver true access, we have to drive the open access movement alongside changing values and promotion systems in the universities. We've got to somehow pick up on the vision of that vibrant Brazilian and African music movement that we saw yesterday and translate that into South-South arrangements in research exchange. We have to provide support for publication efforts. Why is it in the United States a journal editor will get time off teaching in order to publish a journal, whereas in Africa it's a lonely struggle? We have to, and this is very little recognized, expand the range of publications. We focus on journals and maybe monographs. But if you want to ensure the social impact of research, you have to do a whole lot more. And one of the things we discovered in South Africa was the bottom, bigger part of the iceberg. That there is a huge volume of research being pumped out, translated into socially accessible forms by NGOs in South Africa. They all put their stuff online, without sometimes you put a copyright notice saying all rights reserved, and there's another notice saying you can do what you like with this. But basically their ethos is you put it online and informally you have to let people use it. This is not recognized. It's called grey literature. And in the Sarua survey, and this, the result should be published within a few weeks, a few startling things emerged there. One was that grey literature is almost totally inaccessible in the libraries of African universities. The other, which really shook me, was that African scholars in the 8 countries surveyed in Southern Africa said they could not access African journals. They couldn't access the journals in their own country or from their neighboring countries. And this is dire. I mean, it figures with what I know about scholarly publishing, was if you publish in print in Africa, you hit a brick wall immediately you try and cross your border. There are too many barriers, tariff barriers, finance barriers, currency exchange to translate knowledge. But the fact that right across sub-Saharan Africa, researchers can't read each other's work, I think is a critical indication of failure and a critical call to do something dramatic. So here we have Electric Bookworks in South Africa publishing manuals for healthcare workers. And the business model is very interesting. The manuals are available free online. They're very high quality. They're developed out of the pediatric care unit at the University of Cape Town. And if you want, the business model is if the healthcare workers, and remember these AIDS victims I'm talking about need community healthcare. If you want a qualification, you pay for that. It's linked to a course. But the information is free and freely available anywhere in the world. And the other thing that's forgotten, of course, is that science popularization is terribly important. And we've discovered publishers who turn over massive volumes of publications. A tiny company called the Storyteller Group did an AIDS comic book for the province of Gauteng and printed 8 million copies for circulation in Gauteng, paid for by the Gauteng government. But the director said to me, needs to go further. Why can't we give it to all the other provinces? And that's where open access comes in. If all of these publications were available digitally with business models for downloads and print, we would get a massive increase in access to knowledge. So my final word is, having criticized our tendency to follow belatedly after the North, let's now try and catch up with the North in terms of Harvard, which has just set up a mandate for repositories. And Harvard said very publicly and loudly, it is our duty and our mission to disseminate our research. Stanford University, equally the strategic publishing person in Stanford, Caroline Candy, said, when you publish research, publishing research for community use is part of the central mission of doing and disseminating research. And that's what I'd like to leave you with.
We're ready for questions. And while we're moving toward questions, I want to bring back up my slide of the bios of these four panelists. But meantime, by the way, how many minutes do we have for Q&A? 15? 20? 15 or 20? First, I have to figure this out. Just give me. Okay, question?